What's going on, good people? I know you miss me. It's been an entire week, but I'm back. And I have something very special for you today. Today, we are going to have our first ever Chimcast. And you'll understand when we get to it. Oh, you will. I think what you kind of been seeing now in the first couple episodes, you started to see a trend, right? And we're starting to kind of move on to more and more important topics. So for today's topic, what I really want to discuss is I want to discuss social injustice. And I thought it was extremely important to get one of the most intelligent men that I know. I've known this gentleman for damn near 20 years. And let me introduce to you the most amazing guy I know, not named Jonathan Brown, Mr. Chimzy Akobi. Round of applause, please.
What up?
How are you, good sir?
Thank you, sir. Thank you for that illustrious introduction. I don't even know how to follow that up with anything else besides, you know, stay black, God bless America.
Well, I'm glad that you went that route early. So a little bit on my last pod, we actually touched on social injustice, and it just made me start to think. I was like, you know what? I want to dive into this topic a little bit more. And I know from just many of our conversations throughout the years, it was a great opportunity to bring you on because your perspective is typically completely different from my perspective. So it's a great opportunity to kind of balance out two extremes. So, Chim, well, go ahead.
Let me jump the gun and first say that, you know, I'm glad you're back. I'm glad the pod is back. And we're not always diametrically opposed. It's just some things, you know, we just have different viewpoints, but it's all on the spectrum and it's all relative.
Well, I appreciate that. So let's get right into it. Let's start our wonderful discussion. And Chim, I'll let you kick it off for us. What do you want the people to know about social injustice before we start to really dive in? Do we need to give them a foundation? Do we need to give them a little backstory?
Yes. Okay. So the backstory right now is it's end of July-ish 2020, and the country is in what people might consider unrest, even though for many persons of color, definitely many black people, we've seen this version of unrest as just a regular Tuesday in our lives because there's a tale of two Americas, and the difference between the Americas is vast in some places. And for us, you know, the recent deaths of people like George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and so on and so forth have been a consistent visual in our minds and in our lives. So for the rest of America just to notice this because of the pandemic and because of coronavirus and people being at home and actually seeing what's going on, for once, it's like America got awoke. But for Black America, for, you know, many of us, we've already seen this and we know this and we live it. So, you know, we're just here to, like, you know, use this opportunity to expand on this notion for people who don't know or who just, I guess, maybe let's say they just got woke or they're just entering the woke waters. Some of us, we've been swimming to the deep end for literally a lifetime. So
that's a good point. And I think it's funny because I think right now it's like the perfect storm, right? To your point, right now, as the entire world is facing a pandemic, so you almost have to just pretty much stop what you're doing and you're forced to pay attention. I think if we didn't have this pandemic, a lot of what's been occurring, like you mentioned, probably would have been swept underneath the rug. But now you're almost forced to think about all of these various different issues. And then, you know, kind of like you mentioned, you got so much, like so many important people, unfortunately, passed away, like John Lewis. John Lewis is probably one of the most significant people in our, I won't even say our generation, because it's even our parents' generation, but just one of the most influential people that we know. And his passing was absolutely tragic. Go ahead, Chim.
Yeah, and John Lewis just passed away of pancreatic cancer at the age of 80. He was one of the heads of SNCC, which is the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was one of these committees that was actually followed by the FBI and COINTELPRO in the 60s as what people would consider un-American forces back then in the J. Edgar Hoover America. And that wasn't that long ago, because from there, he ended up becoming a congressman. We most famously, many people probably famously know him as the guy who was almost beaten to death on Selma, where the movie Selma comes from, on that bridge, whatever that guy's name, Pettus Bridge. And you have many images of him and other peace protesters, nonviolent protesters going against segregation in the South at the time, in Alabama and other places in the South, as well as in the North. But the segregation could be a story for another day. But that's really a guy who embodied the movement, as well as embodied, you know, the struggle that Black people have been fighting, let's just say in the post-Brown versus Board of Education America, which at this point, that was Brown versus Board of Education was around 1956.
Yes.
And we're in 2020.
Which tells you a lot of it's crazy because we've come so far, but at the same token, there's so much more that needs to be done. And I think that's kind of like almost a good segue to just kind of discuss, you know, Chim, what still needs to be done? Like what needs to change? Like I know we have the Black Lives Movement and the Black Lives Matter movement, and that has its own share of controversy. But what still needs to be done? Like what are we expected? What change do we want to see?
Well, I would say it's a complicated subject that, and I'll just, you know, preface it by saying that we cannot solve everything in one day or one year, but we can definitely make strides in our own lifetimes. And right now, and of course, change is a big term because change for some people think that because one party is getting justice, that means that there's an injustice being taken away from somebody who has. And that's not the case. What we're really striving for is an equitable society for all. We don't want just a few people. Right now, America, if you look at the numbers, 330 million people, and many of those people are living in poverty. Many of those people are struggling. And when you talk about the fight for equality, let's just say, when we talk about the fight for racial equality, we also have to look at the fight for equality of justice, equality of poverty, equality of wealth, access. The rich are getting richer. The poor are either remaining poor or getting poorer just because the rich are getting richer. So while we may talk about how, you know, the struggle of Black people in this country is going to be a continual one, but that's part of it because of the systems that are in place are not systems that are for mass equality for all. And whether you, because I'm sure some people may not be Black and they're like, I don't understand what Black people always complaining about, or I don't understand what these people always complaining about, Hispanic people always complaining about, these people are complaining about, so on and so forth. People have just gripes because the country is not equitable and we're just trying to strive for a more equitable country. So some immediate things that we can look at, if there's only a few things you take away from this entire podcast, and we're going to get into other aspects outside of, you know, the movement, because the movement could be, sometimes for some people, the movement could be too much. Like, it's like, I don't want to be educated right now. I just want to listen to, like, no offense to these people, I just want to listen to, like, Katy Perry or Ying Yang Twins or Justin Bieber or
You start to date yourself there, buddy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, Doja Cat. I mean, how many other people? Like, we could talk about regular people, too. We could talk about Lizzo. Like, if you want to just be entertained, this country, America, United States of America, is great at entertaining people. But it's not great at educating people. And not just educating people, but, like, allowing them empathy. Not just understanding where you're from, but understanding where these other people who are fighting for rights that you may not understand are coming from. So there's a lot of stuff that we could get into. But if there's only things, there's, like, three or four things you could leave this you know, podcast, this Chimcast or JB cast or JB versus everybody, JB versus inequality for this specific segment. If there's three or four things you can understand, it's one, everybody has a part to play. Two, if you feel like you're in power or you're in charge, try to listen to other people and try to make other people's experience just as equitable as the experience you got. Three, that no one is all knowledgeable. Nobody has all the information. Not everybody has all the sources, the facts. Definitely check for yourself. But not everybody knows everything, and that sometimes you have to meet people where they are and get them where they need to be for them to be useful in the society, and also so they don't get canceled, whatever cancel culture means. and then lastly, you know, somebody told me this when I was maybe when we were in college or something like that. There's a simple rule: just don't be an asshole. Simple. Just don't be an asshole. If you think you're being an asshole, just don't be one. Like, see what assholes do and just do the opposite of that. If you see, like, assholes are, like, you know, saying, you know, all lives matter or are taking a knee on people's necks, then be like, I don't want to be that. I want to be the opposite of that. Those are very simple things that you could just follow. And the rest of that stuff you're going to learn because we're all learning. Like, where we're at in July 2020 is very different from where we were at July 2019. Like, this time last year, I was over there planning vacations like everybody else. But, you know, this moment calls for more than just, you know, token investment or token praise or annual giving. It calls for actual action.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned that. So, you know, yes, I absolutely agree. Don't be an asshole. If you think you're being an asshole, you're probably being an asshole. Just food for thought. But you mentioned a few different things, and I guess this is also a nice little segue. I kind of wanted to go back to one of the points that you mentioned. I really want to kind of focus on the Black Lives Matter movement, right? Because like you mentioned, you know, not everyone is so invested in the movement. So a little history, right? So Black Lives Matter movement, that really began based off of Trayvon Martin's death. Right, George Zimmerman, his bitch ass, he got acquitted in that wonderful state of Florida. And that was, I want to say, almost like 4 or 5 years ago. And throughout
2014 was when Trayvon Martin was killed. So at this point, it's like 6 years ago. But yeah,
geez, time is flying. So you're looking at 5, 6 years ago. And throughout the last 5, 6 years, we've literally just seen the same story being replayed over and over and over and over again, and nothing has changed. And something that you mentioned before, it's like, I hate to even say it, but black lives, black people, it's like there's two sets of rules. There's rules for us, and then there's rules for other people. And getting back to your point, just in terms of equality, let's kind of start there with our wonderful justice system. And I know we can probably spend hours on this conversation, but there's a few highlights, right? So we keep hearing defund the police. So I just wanted your take on that first before we continue our segue. So what, you know, we keep hearing that term defund the police. How do you feel about that? Do you feel that actually will help our movement or hinder our movement?
I think defund the police is a useful term for those who are on the far left spectrum. And by say far left, I mean, we're not talking about like necessarily like political parties as much as like ideologies. So like someone who's very liberal in ideology, which doesn't actually follow the political parties, would now say defund the police, that the police need to be out of the communities that they serve, that they're overdoing it. And it's a little bit more complex than that, because I understand why people say defund the police, and I actually understand why there's pushback against it, because it's a little too radical for the average person who thinks that they were radical before by just protesting. So there's always a further left, if you think about it, just like there's always a further right. Some people say, hey, we need to give the military, you know, 60% of our GDP. And then some people are like, why not 80%? You know, so there's always a different spectrum that we're working on. So when people say defund the police, my understanding of it is let's say there's a $100 budget for an entire city. And in most budgets these days, the police are getting anywhere from 30%, which is $30, to 60%, which is $60. So if you're saying, if you're on the end of the spectrum where the police are getting $60 of the $100 budget, that means there's only $40 left for everything else, including if you have a fire, if you have EMTs, like you have a heart attack, stroke, if you have regular funds like after school programs. Before, there used to be this thing called like PAL, Police Athletic League, in like places like New York City, where funds are now re-perpetrated for, instead of it being 60, if that $60 was going to the police, they will now say, well, if you're gonna get $60, five of those have to go to like these community service events that now place the police in within the community they serve. So when people are saying defund the police, there's like different aspects to it. So some people don't want that $60 that's going to the police. They want that to be closer to 30. And some people who want the police to get only that $30 in this example probably want it to be more like 5 or like 0. Because 0 is just not really attainable. But even if you say like you're trying to defund the police, like you want police to be somewhere around 10% of the budget and you have 90% for other services, just because you said that you're giving, taking away that 20% from the police, doesn't mean that that 20% from the police, or that if the police only get 10%, that percentage of the police is actually going to be adequately distributed to other places. So it's not a, it's like you can't, it's not like space where you make, where you count books made, where if I have top five, you have Ace Trek, and we're on the same team, we're pretty much looking at, as long as we don't bump heads, we're pretty much looking at 8 or 9 books just by showing up, right? It's not like that, because we don't know who's actually in control of the monies. So even in a place like New York City, while you might say the NYPD is getting, you know, 40% of the budget, we don't know if the mayor is in charge of the reallocation. We don't know if the comptroller is in charge of the reallocation. We don't know if the actual NYPD commissioner is in charge of that reallocation, or somewhere in between, or maybe it's a borough commissioner. So there's so much bureaucracy in between that just because you defunded the police doesn't actually mean that those services are now going to immediately go directly to those after-school programs that we talked about, to those extra help programs that we talked about, back into education for these schools that are struggling to maintain state grades. There's no guarantee that those, unless you literally appoint some version of a direct comptroller that oversees the reallocation funds, and even then that's a temporary position, you can't really guarantee that just because you defunded the police that mass corruption won't happen. Because as we know from just general understanding of how corruption works, that the absolute corrupt, absolutely, they're not gonna take this opportunity as a chance to be like, well, you know what, I'm gonna pull back, I'm actually gonna, like, you know, take this extra money that we took out of the police and I'm gonna reinvest it. As they said, many people might skim off the top, they may make some backside deals and then just take that money, and then now the police are now missing funding, which is okay. Yep. but then so are the actual needs that are still going missing. So now you're having both people getting screwed. So when we say defund the police, you better have all the levers in place to make sure that those funds are actually going back to the community, because that's the most important thing. Right now, the people are crying out because the people's communities have been left, and the only people who are left in that you can actually be that can be held accountable are the police. And many of the police are not actually, one, adequately trained or even a part of the actual community that they serve, thus creating more problems. Because if the people who were serving the community were actually involved, more often than not, you wouldn't have as many deaths like George Floyd, where people understand where these people are coming from. It's like, that's my neighbor. Even if I don't live right next to him, I understand his plight. I understand where he or she's coming from. And I feel like I should be able to relate with them and at least, you know, see this out without it being somebody dying, without somebody getting brutalized by the police.
Yeah, and that's a very good point. Like, for me personally, like, this is a tough conversation for me. Only in a sense, because once you start talking about defunding the police, right? I mean, to your point, it really means about just reallocating resources. So, you know, me and you, we both have a couple of some of our good friends that are police officers, and they do the right thing, you know, for by our standards anyway, that we're aware of. And just the thought process of them not having the resources that they need to do their job is a problem for me, because these are my brothers and I love them. But at the same token, the current system that's in place is just not working. So I did find, like, this, I was doing some research not too long ago, and I found something pretty interesting, that a lot of the calls for 911, they did a survey, and 9 out of 10 of them are nonviolent encounters. And what 9 out of 10. And what typically happens a lot of times, unfortunately, is that police are trained for the most part to use force, you know, use of force tactics. And they're always thinking about, you know, worst case scenario, any potential threats, whether it's potential threats to themselves or potential threats to the people around them. So it kind of makes you think, well, what if we were able to train, and maybe it's not even train, maybe it's just we need a new force entirely that we can send to people that doesn't necessarily, you don't have to deal with any nonviolent encounters, right? You know, maybe that's, you know, increasing your social workers, increasing your mental health workers, and, you know, having them be part of your force to deal with these type of encounters, so that when we do really have to send out a police officer, it's because it's a, God forbid, but it's a life and death situation or some sort of emergency.
It would be good to have that. And I think that's a useful tool. And yes, there's a lot of times when you say 90%, that's a high percentage. And you hope that, like, you know, you have these social workers who are there to help But many of these communities have been so dilapidated that, I mean, no, it may not look like, you know, 1967 or whatever. Like, maybe those communities have had a few more, you know, gadgets and technology, but for the most part, you're talking about people who's really struggling. So if you're trying to bring a mental health counselor to somebody who has not received the adequate mental health in the last, let's say, 10 years, you're still going to need to have somebody who can actually, you know, not, I won't even say put them down by any stretch of imagination, but somebody who could at least, you know, show some version of force that will prevent them from actually, you know, being a harm to the community around them as well as to others. So, like, it's not just because we've gone so far. Like, I feel like some of these plans would have been a great idea. Like, it would be a great idea to just have, like, social workers go with, like, some of these EMTs or social workers go with some of the cops. But I feel like some places have been so left behind that some of the people that they're going to help need, have been left in the dirt for so long that they need so much basic help that, like, you can see why the police, if they come in there, they're going to automatically have a more defensive approach, which is not what you need. And because, but part of the reason why is because we've left these communities for, you know, the country has left these communities for so long that now there's, you know, you only have the police that are left, and they have a, you know, it's almost like they have a specific method. And a lot of times that method is not good for the person who you call the police on. So 90% is way too much. Now, hopefully if we do change, if we do reallocate some of those resources, you know, at least the police officer feels like, okay, while I'm approaching this, you know, social or mental health problem, I can at least, you know, fall back until the person who we come, I could go with the counselor, I could go with the mediator, I could go with the social worker. And for the most part, I'm just standing back, making sure nothing gets out of hand, but I'm not actually the first person of the line of defense. I'm not introducing myself. I'm just in the corner, so to speak, unless things get out of hand. Now, there, and of course, it depends on the call. Sometimes, you know, some people are in such a state of disarray or dismay that they just need to call. They're like, we got to call somebody. And because we haven't really trained people to not call 911, I remember even as a kid, you know, by maybe first or second grade, most children who are 7 or 8 years old are learning that 911 is what you need to call if there's any emergency. But now, you know, you almost have to like reteach this at the youngest level that, yes, 911 is for emergencies, but you might want to call if it's like 511 or something like that for a non-health emergency. Now, of course, now that still leaves it in the hands of the person who witnesses it. If I witness a car accident on the road, if it's a fender bender, I'll probably, if I know better, I'll be like, all right, I know 511, it might be that number. As opposed to like, I got into that fender bender and I still gotta call 911, and then I still have to go through the process of saying, well, this is a non-emergency, so they're gonna take me to 511 anyway. So there's many levels to it in terms of, you know, the severity of the call. And while 90% of those may not necessarily be a physical altercation, I still feel like you'll still need to have somebody there who has some version of training for when things don't go according to plan until our society catches up.
But I guess to your point, or just to kind of play devil's advocate,
of course,
if you're in a situation and you have to call 911, seeing two people come out of a car with a gun, doesn't that automatically escalate the situation? Even just the anxiety of the situation that, you know, you're in, or maybe just the people that are made the phone call, that's going to increase everyone's anxiety. And, you know, not everyone handles anxiety the best ways. They can easily escalate to more violent activities, which, again, unfortunately, can end up with someone getting hurt.
Oh, of course. And I think, and that does happen, that there's a chance that whenever you see an escalation, and that's why you almost want to have some version of people that is cops who are still working the beat, you know, in these communities, so you actually don't feel, you know, as threatened, because these people are not people that you haven't seen before. Whereas, like, a lot of times, like the scenario in Atlanta where the guy was just asleep by that Wendy's, then you call the cops and all of a sudden it goes from something that could have been de-escalated to the man's death. And those are, I think his name is Elijah McCain. So I think these are the types of scenarios that happen. And while it would be nice not to see some sort of escalation, the problem with our own country, and this is the difference between America versus like places in Western Europe or even Eastern Europe at this point, where there aren't that many guns on the streets, So it's very difficult. It's very rare to see a scenario where you need to escalate anything. Whereas now, America, one of the sad things that we do right now is we manufacture entertainment and we manufacture guns, which means that there's a lot of guns on the street. And ones that we haven't manufactured here, we've sent to other countries to handle their quote-unquote police situations. So even if you say, I want to, you know, demilitarize the police, which is definitely fine and dandy, you should definitely demilitarize the police in terms of, like, they should not be showing up in riot gear like you're seeing in Portland right now, or like you saw in D.C. a month or some change ago. They should never be showing up in riot gear because they're now escalating a situation that did not need to be escalated. But in certain scenarios where you're coming to someone's house, especially depending on what part of the country you're in, you could easily be in, let's say you're in Amarillo, Texas, you go to someone's house for a regular phone call, that person may be strapped to the wazoo and you might have a pistol shooter. That's not going to stop anything. In fact, you know, you're almost better off not even going there with a gun because it's just almost, it almost defeats the purpose. So because this gun culture has become so ingrained in our society, and you may not see it in big cities, you may not see it in D.C., you may not see it in New York or even in Chicago that much, because like they actually have like some version of regulations on some of their weapons, but you still are in a scenario where there are so many guns that are not even registered all over the country that you still don't feel comfortable as a giving. If I was in charge of police, I still wouldn't feel comfortable putting them in a call where the person, that they might get outgunned. And not that you even want that to escalate. It's just the nature of the business of this country is we have literally millions of guns sold in this country. And not all of them are, most of them aren't even registered. So it's very difficult to find out, to place, you know, someone who's supposed to be a protector of the peace without a peace. And that's why, you know, you still want to, even though you don't want to necessarily have guns for certain scenarios, but you don't want to have one force. So in other words, I don't want to have, okay, I'm living in town A and I've defunded the police and I've only given them tasers and, you know, light batons. You could do that in a place like England where there just aren't that many guns that are available to the average person. And then in town B, they're, you know, they have weapons, they have guns, they have shotguns, they have all these other things. So essentially, the person needs to do is go to town B, and then they're now strapped up, and then your police force at town A is looking silly. So those are the things that you still need to, like, you know, factor in when you're sending your police, because you still want good police. So even though you have, like, even though you can say community training, you still need people who are not afraid to do a good job. And that means that they have to have a certain mindset to go into certain scenarios, because not everybody's trained for that. And even now, we can see that a lot of people have decent training and they still make mistakes. And one thing that I can say is police should do some version of zero tolerance. Like, you make a version of a mistake that happened that ended up killing a guy like George Floyd or let's say Philando Castile, then you're done. You can't be in any force ever. In fact, besides just pressing charges, you can't just move to another part of the country now, just be on another police force. That should never be an option for you.
Well, I guess that also, it brings up an interesting topic. So what about all the people that say, so first, let me be very clear to my audience and to everyone out there. This is not us bashing any cops by any means. Like I said, a lot of our friends are cops. We're just having an open and candid conversation. So let me put that disclaimer out there before they come and get me. I have enough issues being a black man dealing with officers. But on a more serious note, I guess it kind of segue again into another interesting topic. Well, what about all the people that say, yeah, we're talking about the police and we're talking about how they're treating people, but what about how black people are treating black people in our own community? How come you guys aren't doing anything to clean up your own communities? What about the black on black violence and all of those type of comments that where they try to move the, or our term, move the goalposts or shape or shift the narrative of the movement?
Yes, that's fair. And thank you for that disclaimer. I don't need to add much more than that. But when people talk about black on black violence, it's stupid. Violence in general is committed based on proximity of access to the person that you're angry at. So most people don't. So they're just like there's quote unquote black and black violence. There's white on white violence. There's blank on blank violence. Any from all spectrums. Don't even want to start randomly naming people to say like, oh yes, if it's you know, Asian on Asian violence, and does that mean you dislike Asian people? No, that's far from the case. I'm just saying that the average version of violence is going to occur to somebody you know, just because you know them, right? Like, it's like you, it doesn't cross your mind to like be. There's very few people that can be very angry at people they just don't know, they've never seen, they've never interacted with. But when you talk about statistics, this guy Michael Harriet of The Root, I think during maybe about a couple months ago, he went down the road of talking about why people keep reciting black on black violence. And what it comes down to is, if, long story short, it comes down to racism. But if you want to go through the steps, it's on a Square page, and The Root kind of looked at this. And what it is that people just throw out black on black violence as a way to just deter any discussion of actually fixing the real problems, the systemic problems at hand. I mean, after all, we're talking about systemic racism. I'm so weird that we've gone this far without mentioning that word. This is systemic, and it's not just the racism, it's systemic classism as well. Like, people are violent when they need to, when they feel like there's no other option, when they're not given other options in life. Also, when they don't have much money, they don't have much food. I mean, we were just looking at a scenario where, and this was just like a theoretical, somebody threw this out to us, and there's a guy who's driving his baby mom's car. Well, let's say his wife's car. We don't even know. We don't even know the scenario, but let's say he's driving.
Let's be respectable. His wife's car. Let's be respectable.
Let's say a man is driving his wife's car, and in that car, his mom, that man's mother, is sitting in the front seat. And as he pulls up to pick up his wife, his mother is looking at his wife, and his wife is mad. The man, that is the driver's wife, is outside the car, about to enter the car, and she wants her mother-in-law, that is her husband's wife, sorry, her husband's mother, to now get out the front seat and go in the back seat of her car so she can drive in the front seat with her husband. And that is a conundrum, but that is a problem that only exists when you don't have the resources to say, well, you know, if I had money, I could just, you know, order you an Uber, or why are you even tripping about this? Because after all, you know, we have plenty of cars at home and they're bigger fish to fry. Like, why does what difference does it make that, you know, my mother is in the front seat or my wife is in the front seat? After all, like, nobody here is 6 years old. Nobody needs to be in the front seat at all. But the calamity of poverty, where they may only have one car and everybody feels possessed to own that car, now has ownership of this proverbial front seat. So that's like a small microcosm of a problem of access to wealth, access to income, that when people have, they don't necessarily have these small, minute problems. So when people talk about, you know, to just circle back around to like things like black and black crime, or the alleged black and black crime, I'm going to air quote that, people talk about that because they're like, well, black people are killing each other. Yes, black people also mostly in poverty based on a bunch of rulings and laws in this country, as well as Jim Crow, the Jim Crow South, as well as the Jim Crow North, as well as the Jim Crow penitentiary system that we currently still have. With all these things in play, you now have a scenario where people are still impoverished and they have to make poor decisions based on the poor education system that left them and abandoned them a long time ago, in addition to all other factors that make it so people are, you know, feeling like their neighbor is their enemy, when in actuality, it's the system that's hovering over all of them that is actually the real enemy. And that's really what we have to change. And when I say we, I mean all of America, because this same poverty exists. You don't necessarily, I mean, I just traveled a little bit of the country on COVID, so I definitely was driving. I wasn't out there flying around.
I was keeping
my social distance.
We care about
you. I've seen trailer park places in different states in this country where people are in poverty. White people are in poverty, serious poverty. Obviously, majority of people on welfare right now are white, that's not a big issue, because that's okay, because it's not, they don't want to care about talking about, you know, why are so many people being left behind? Even the concept of, you know, what Trump was allegedly claiming that he was about in 2014, 2015, 2016, which now turns out to be completely false. But what he was alleging was that people were left behind, and they're still left behind. So when people talk about poverty, this poverty is, it's pervasive, and it's all around this country. A lot of people are poor, And that's why they have, that's why they resort to crime. And if they're not resorting to crime, then they're resorting to drugs. So when you're talking about opium or you know, these overdoses, when you're talking about crack from the 80s or 70s, these are all problems of poverty. And these are things that if you actually had a chance to solve by, you know, getting people jobs, getting people opportunities, getting people, you know, chances to learn and not just get out, not just better their situation, but possibly better the situation around them. Because after all, if I'm the, if I'm a rich person and everyone around me is poor, I too am poor because everybody around me has to now answer to me. And I feel overwhelmed by that scenario. Whereas like, what do we say? High tide rises all ships, all boats. Yep. We need high tide in our communities. We need not just one person getting the job out. We need everybody having a job and opportunity, because then you'll see less crime, because people won't feel like they need to steal. They won't feel like they need to sell. They won't feel like they don't have skills to be a useful member of society.
Yeah, and it, see, it's funny. Now that I'm older, right, you start to kind of replay your life a little. And then all the things that your family, you know, teaches you growing up, and now you kind of get a better understanding of why things are happening the way they are. So for me, born in Brooklyn, raised in Brooklyn, I live in a, but for sure, but and I live in a regular, in a pretty good area. But I remember my mother never wanting me to go to a certain junior high school, which was in a, it was in a, I don't want to say a horrible area, but it wasn't the best area. And by the time I was little, just always in my head, no, you're not going to go to this junior high school, you're going to another one. So the one that I ended up going, my junior high school, was in a predominantly white area. Like, and it never dawned on me, well, why am I going there? But it's because my parents knew, and this is unfortunate, but I would have got a better education going there. And that also kind of opened up more opportunities that I was never even thinking about. So I went there to a predominantly white school for junior high school. Then when I went to high school, I was able to play football from junior, because of the junior high school that I went to. So I was able to skip the whole zoning process that Brooklyn has. And I went into one of the, you know, top four high schools in Brooklyn. Because of that, fast forward later, I got the opportunity to go play football at Stony Brook. So it's just like, it's amazing. It's like, okay, I didn't even think about that decision when I was a young boy, not realizing the impact that it had on me. And like, who knows if I would have went to this other junior high school, that maybe I wouldn't have got the best education, or I would have got a similar education. But then, you know, I probably would have went to a more, I hate to say it, to high school and then probably in a worse area. And then you never know how life plays out from there. And it's just funny. And there's so many little, these little stories and little things that have occurred throughout my entire life that now, being the old man that I am and seeing what's occurring out there in the world, it's just like, wow, okay, this really impacted me when I was young. And this is damn near 30 years ago. And it's still impacting all of us now. And it's like,
yeah, okay, and it's a long-term decision. And not only that, but it's a decision, and everything you said so far outside of college, these are decisions your parents made. These aren't decisions that you had to make. Yeah. Whereas people are getting mad at people making decisions where it's like the blind leading the blind. Like if your mom doesn't have the foresight or your dad doesn't have the foresight of saying, hey, look at the scenario that we're in, and here's a way that we can better you as well as better your life. And then this way, if you end up being successful, you can also better their lives, right?
Yeah.
But without that knowledge, how are you going to now just all of a sudden do better when nobody around you even has that opportunity? No one around you has gone to school before. No one around you has been successful in a legit way before. So when you, and also in addition to that, imaging, like if you only see minorities on TV and they're either dribbling a basketball or throwing a basketball or football, or they're, you know, if they're only in some version of sport, you only think that that's the only option for you. And that's not the case. But that's only when you don't, when you're not presented with other opportunities. So a lot of times when people have these, you know, conversations, it's like, well, look around the people who are of influence in your life at a young age, way before you even had an opportunity to make a decision. A lot of the good decisions are made before you and give you that option. And many people in this country don't even have anything close to that option. And we're expecting them to just all of a sudden, you know, because a few people marched or because you passed a small bill here or there, to now all of a sudden just become masters of a domain that they've never been to, they've never seen before. They still live in the same scenario. So even if they have this enlightenment, it's like, okay, I'm enlightened, but everywhere around me is still dilapidated. All the people around me are still not looking towards that. Okay, so what are my peers doing? My peers are in the same scenario, right? So all these things are interesting. And actually, this is like very similar to what we talked about, or better yet, this is what they talked about in the Kerner Commission. So back in 1967, after the riots in like, let's call them quote unquote riots in Detroit and all across the Midwest, Cleveland, Chicago, even New York, Lyndon Johnson came up with this idea of having the Kerner Commission, where it was named after some guy, where he, long story short, they were supposed to look at what was causing all the social unrest, and I'm air quoting social unrest, in America. This was back in 1967. And after they came back and looking at some of the places from Milwaukee all the way down to Houston and Atlanta and New York, they went through all these cities around the country, and they came up with the reason why that the country's struggling is because there's a tale of two Americas. There's a Black America and there's a white America, and all in between. And in Black America, the city has been, you know, the country's abandoned its people, where you have white flight, you have gentrification, actually not even gentrification. You just have people leaving the city for the suburbs and then leaving everything else for the people who are just left there to without jobs, without opportunities. And then in addition to that, you have no jobs. So if you do have a job, it's like a small job that can actually get you out of the current state that you're in. So at that point, they said that there needs to be some sort of equitable redistribution to allow for some of these people in these inner cities to have a realistic opportunity at the quote-unquote American dream. And this was brought back to Lyndon Johnson at the time when he was fighting Vietnam. Literally, the country, America's pouring billions of dollars into Vietnam and then not looking at home, looking to how to help people within, you know, its own country. And rather than deal with that problem, they let it go. And while they tried to add some things in, after about 10 years or so, by the mid-70s, they just abandoned it. Like, the country just left everybody up to their own devices. And that's where you start seeing the beginning of, you know, things like crack and all these other drugs that come into the system, because people had no way out and there was nowhere else to turn. So sometimes history repeats itself, and we're kind of living that in a different way. Like, you know, nowadays, you know, back in the day, they said that, you know, Gil Scott-Heron, RIP, would say that the revolution would not be televised. But today, the revolution is televised. We're seeing a lot. You can be at home and scroll through Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook and see a lot of things happening that, you know, people would never see back then. You'd only hear about it. You wouldn't even be on the news. Like, very few people had the access to footage or able to, you know, record what was happening in their communities. Now, yep, you're starting to see it. And if anything, we're getting overload of it. It's like too much. It's like, could I like see something else? I just want to watch like cats and dogs on Twitter and just like the nice peaceful life. But life isn't peaceful these days. It's the realities of the street are, you know, amongst us all. So there's nowhere to go. And with the pandemic, there's nowhere to go. You can't hide anymore. Nobody could just be like, well, you know, that's their problem. I'm just going to go on vacation to Greece or something. And, you know, let me live. Everybody else, now we're kind of stuck here. And because we haven't handled the pandemic, we're really stuck here. We can't even leave the country if we wanted to. So yeah. These are all things where history is repeating itself. And hopefully, you know, even through this, you know, small discussion and dialogue, we could, you know, try to make people feel better about it while also talking about, like, you know, being pro-Beehive and pro-Navy. You know what I mean?
So this guy over here. So with that being said, I guess this is a nice way to kind of also conclude the pod. So how do we continue these conversations? How do we have these difficult conversations with people that may not be so open to this conversation? What are our next steps? Like, how do we continue the fight and make sure that this doesn't get swept underneath the rug? Like, we know that we have a huge election that's coming in a couple of months, and we need to make sure that every single vote literally counts. So how do we just continue that conversation, Jim? How do we have these difficult conversations with the people that need to have them?
I mean, honestly, what I've been having, especially like when the beginning of the protests happened, when I started to hear from so many of my Caucasian comrades around the globe, I think the best thing we could do is empower. We need to empower people. And that is, if people come up to you and they're asking questions, like I always say, like, you know, it's not your job, it's not our job as Black people to teach anybody about anything. But, you know, for the safety of myself, as really for the safety of my kids, my future kids, I want to make sure that the people that are eventually going to become in power in this country, even if they're not in power now, a lot of them are millennials, a lot of them are Gen X. Some of the people right behind us, Gen Z, are going to be the leaders of this country while we're living in it. So we want to make sure that they know that while they may not feel like they can do something now, they can at least sow the seeds for them to do something in the future. And also, sometimes the biggest discussions, just like with your job and, you know, promotions and things of that sort, the biggest discussions about you are had without you in the room, right? You know, when someone's looking over your college application or your grad school application, none of us are in the room when that's happening, right? When someone's looking over whether they're going to give you a scholarship, you're not in the room. When someone's looking over giving you a promotion, you're not in the room for that. So it's one of those things where we have to empower these people to say, hey, you know, if you're, you know, let's say you're Irish, you're English, whatever, you're French, you're white French, that is, and you're amongst a wine, you're in a wine distillery with your friends and you hear something racist. Now, you could just sweep that under the rug. You have, I mean, that's a problem. Before, it's not just, somebody said this, I think it was Emmanuel Achaw from the former NFL player. I think he's on good, I think he's on Good Morning Football now. But he said, it's not just about being non-racist, it's about being anti-racist. So when you see something, especially as a white person, you see something in your own community, if you're Asian, if you're Hispanic, if you're, you know, Middle Eastern, you see something in your community, it's not just about ignoring it and say, ah, that's just, you know, Uncle Lou, or that's just Aunt, you know, Aunt Beatrice, whatever. That's long. You know, they're going to eventually get old and they're going to tire out. It's about also being anti-racist. It's about saying, you know what? I think you're wrong there, and you're not having the facts, and you're incorrect about this because this, this, and that. And you have two or three things to let them know. Like, while you may have gotten away with saying some slick stuff like that before, and you might be a product of your time, times are changing. And, you know, especially if you're talking about somebody who's like, you know, let's say 60 and younger, you know, you still have like a decent amount of time on this earth. You have a way to communicate to people, and this might be better off. This might better you. You know, it may better those people around you. Because this is cancel culture. Like, people are getting drugged through the mud on social media as well as in life because of mistakes that they're making. I mean, how many people have I seen get fired because they're being racist and on camera? And people are like, "Yo, you're on camera," and they're like, "I don't care." And then next thing you know, you find out, like, no matter where, though, it's like, "Oh yeah, I need this job." It's like, you need to think about that. And that could have been prevented if somebody in your family or somebody around you was like, "Hey, look, you can't just be like, I can't allow you to be racist anymore." Like, I'm going to call you out on it. And while it may be annoying to you, I got to do it because that's not just my duty, but that's what I can do. Because, you know, when racism gets called out within the mass community, that's really when you see real change happen. Because we're always going to call it racism because, you know, more often than not, it directly affects persons of color. So we're for the most part, on average, because, you know, there are some questionable characters out there. Let's put it that way. We are definitely going to call it out, but we need other people from other communities to also call it out. And that's really where you start seeing real progress happen. Part of the reason why these protests really became big were because, you know, the media couldn't ignore the fact that it was a multicultural, multilingual, multi-ethnic protest. It wasn't just, the black people are marching. It must be mad that a black person got killed. No, people are marching because they're mad that people got killed. The end. And that's how we're going to tell people. We're going to empower them. Hey, in your community, when you see something, you say something. You see some racist shit, you call it out. And that's really how you help them. It's like, and not just like, yo, call it out. And then just like, if you don't, not everybody's equipped to be an advocate. Not everybody's equipped to be a voice of the people. But you have to say, hey, here are the couple things you can say. Like, hey, Uncle Lou, maybe you should probably look into your thoughts and why you think black people are this, that, and the third. Why you think Hispanic people are this, that, and the third. And maybe here's a couple of pamphlets of great works that these people have done to make this, you know, make this country a better place, to make this country work. You know, the amount of inventions that our people have made to make this country work, you know, that's not taught in schools, and that's another thing, education, you know, but a lot of times you just got to give people the right access to tools. And I'll just leave it there. That's what we need. We need to empower people to make changes within their own community, because you make small changes there, and then you'll start seeing massive changes happen across the board.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think the few things that I would add to that, me personally, just based on my experience and my position that I will, of course, not name because I don't want to get fired or anything like that, but my few positions I should say. I think the very first point that I do want to kind of just quickly make, what I find is that if it doesn't impact them, they don't really care. It sounds horrible. Don't get me wrong. There's a lot of people out there that they're just good people, right? So there is some empathy with what's occurring. But until it truly hits home, it doesn't affect them. And I think that's one of the tough conversations that you have to have with people is, okay, I have to live with this every single day because people are judging me based on my skin tone. You can go home to your family and sleep well at night. God forbid, you know, I still, you know, well, before the pandemic, but like if I go to a store, I'm still being followed around. People thinking that I'm going to shoplift when I can buy and sell their asses anytime I want. And it's like these little things. Last year I was pulled over when I was parking just because I was in a white area and I have a nice car. This is my car, officer. This is my registration. I own this. I'm good. And it's sad, but you know, these are the realities that I have to deal with. And you know, a lot of my coworkers, they don't have to deal with this type of stuff. So I've been actually having a few conversations at work. One of the things I've actually been doing is I've been participating in a couple of diversity panels. And I just kind of been telling my own personal stories. For those who don't know, my brother passed away when I was really young, and he was shot by a police officer when they thought that he was robbing a car. He was just straight racially profiled, and he was shot. Officers continued working, never got fired, nothing. It was a little blurb in the Daily News, and that was it. But that impacted literally hundreds of people in my family. And, you know, when you start to see everything that's kind of occurring in the news, it just brings back all these old memories. And it's just like, oh, another one, geez. And then you're starting to hurt. And then you just start thinking about all the people that has gone through all of these different tragedies as well. And like I said, you know, some of the coworkers that I have, once they heard my story, you seen the eyes light up. Now you see them perking up. Now it's like, oh, okay, this is impacting people I know. And I see how hurt he is. And I see what he's going through. And they're much more receptive to the conversation. And I think that's the first start. And that's what you're really looking for. Because, you know, to your point that you made earlier, change is not going to happen overnight. But you have to keep working toward that goal, just like anything in life. Every single day is, how did I get better today? How did I work toward my goal? And that's the same thing with this particular movement. The kids that I mentor, and I hate to even say this, but it gets to the point where we're in a type of world where you're literally telling these kids that they have to work harder than others just because of their skin color. And that goes back to to the points that she was making about equality. It shouldn't have to be like that. At the end of the day, is this is my performance. I'm being judged based on my performance. Even in my own, go ahead.
And that's the way it should be. And that's the way we want it to be. And, you know, sorry about your brother. I mean, I know the story, but, you know, just for you, thank you for sharing that on record. And these are the type of scenarios that come up. And people wonder, like, why people are so, you know, apprehensive to the police. Like, they're fearful. Why? Because they know these stories. They've lived these stories. If it wasn't them, then it's somebody that they knew. And, you know, these encounters are things that you almost want to avoid at all costs. And sometimes, you know, there are people who are literally making decisions. Hey, should I buy this nice vehicle or should I buy this nice house? Because, you know, while I enjoy it, I don't know if I want the problems that may come with it. Right.
Yep. And that's extremely sad. It's like you work hard. You're trying to do the right thing and you're being judged for almost doing the right thing, which makes absolutely no sense. And just really just the last point that I really want to make, and kind of just going back to, you know, just educating our youth, our future generation, it's unfortunate, but it's come to a point where you're literally teaching them that you have to work harder than everyone else, not to get ahead, but just so you can almost be equal to your counterparts. I'll leave it at that.
And I appreciate that, and thank you for sharing. Thank you for having me as well. I just want to point out again that I am pro Beyonce. I also want to say that I think Snoop Dogg won the Versus battle against DMX, although no, the hip hop won in all, but I think Snoop Dogg won. But I just want to put those things out there. And thank you for the platform, and keep on keeping on.
Well, we definitely appreciate having you on, Mr. Colby, for our first ever Chimcast. And I'm looking forward to future Chimcasts, hopefully not about such a serious conversation.
Thank you, sir. Got the government out and everything, huh?
Well, I do it for the people. Where can the people follow you if they want to follow up with any questions or discussions, or do you don't want to talk to them? It's up to you.
I mean, you got my whole government out there. I guess they could follow me on LinkedIn at this point. Shit. Right. No, I would say Twitter is fine.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot. They can contact me to get to you. It's fine.
Yeah, no, it's all good. I don't want to give you that extra burden. I mean, you got plenty of jobs. You don't need another one. At Chimmy O Triumph on Twitter. For now, we'll see. We might change it, but that's good enough for now.
Well, thank you for your time, sir. I'm sure my audience will appreciate this educational pod, and I will talk to you later.
Yes, sir. Talk to you later.